The sutta we are doing today is number 7 of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's known as the Vat Upama Sutta, the simile of the cloth. Page 118 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Has everybody got a copy of the sutta? Everybody has? Okay. So, as usual, I'm just going to read through the sutta. I'm going to comment as I go along to explain any difficult points or whatever. And if anybody has any questions, please just raise your hand at any time if there's anything you want to ask about or want to comment on or whatever. Okay, so this is how it goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove and at the Pindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, it would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Because suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected." So here, basically, the Buddha is saying that if you have a defiled mind, then you would tend towards an unhappy destination in the future. It's to be expected. And the simile here of the cloth, I must admit, I'm not 100% sure exactly how it works. But the point seems to be that when you, after you die, after you pass away, there is like a transition state afterwards before you take rebirth. And if in that transition state you have a defiled mind, it's as if you move towards a defiled or painful state because of that defiled mind. The mind is not able to become, to be attracted, so to speak, to a pure place when it is defiled in its own right. And maybe what is meant here is that as you probably all look upon this matter anyway as Buddhist, when you pass away, one of the things that happens when you pass away is that you let go of the body, obviously. And letting go of the body is usually considered something which is very pleasurable. It's a freeing from a burden, and it's a feeling of joy and freedom and peace when you let go of the body. And if you have a pure mind, then you experience that joy and peace and happiness of getting free from the body. And that is, in a sense, the mind becoming beautiful and being attracted to the beautiful because of the freeing from the body. However, if you have a defiled mind, it doesn't matter if you get that freedom from the body, because you will still have those defilements in the mind, and you won't be able to experience the joy and happiness of that freedom because of the defilements of the mind. So the freedom of the body here can be understood as the dying, maybe. And then when that dying happens, if your mind is defiled, you don't experience the happy results of that liberation from the body because of the defilements of the mind. And this is just my kind of theory, what could be meant here, one possible interpretation perhaps. But it may not be that it should be interpreted so much at all. Maybe it's just a kind of very general way of looking at the rebirth process. So anyway, so this is the simile based on which the sutta is named, obviously. So then the Buddha goes on. Now he talks about the actual defilements of the mind, which are mentioned in this particular simile here. So what, bhikkhus, are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Resentment, probably hostility might be a better translation there. Hostility, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice should probably be stinginess, and then deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. So here we have a large number of defilements of the mind, and you might perhaps ask, why is there such a long list of defilements here? Usually in Buddhism we're talking about the five hindrances to meditation, but here you have this whole list, I think it's 16 altogether in here. Does this make any difference? Is this any different from the five hindrances? And I think essentially the five hindrances are what we need to focus on. That is the standard kind of Buddhist explanation of the problems of the mind, the five hindrances. And that is, you know, what our main focus should be on, because that is what is mentioned in the suttas again and again and again. The five hindrances occur time after time in the suttas. Whereas these particular 16 defilements, I think they only occur in this particular sutta. So they're much more rare. But I think the point is, the point of having a long list like this is to show us that the five hindrances are like a kind of overarching umbrella which has many greater details to it than you can actually see in the five hindrances. And a lot of these imperfections that you find here, you would say they don't naturally fit into the five hindrances at all. Like, you know, things like maybe conceit and arrogance, or maybe envy and vanity. They are like, you know, they sort of fall outside of that scope. So it's important to remember that these still, even though they don't fall within the five hindrances, that they still are a problem. They're still going to hinder your progress on the path. So because of that, there still are obstacles that you have to overcome. And of course, all of these things, many of these things, like conceit and arrogance and vanity, have their basis in the idea of a self, the idea that you compare yourself to other people. That's why you have vanity and arrogance and conceit. So the self idea is obviously a large factor here in many of these defilements here. One defilement that is very important is the last one. It's here translated as negligence. And the latest translation that Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi uses for this word, this is the appamada in Pali. It's a very important word. You find it everywhere in the suttas. Is heedlessness is the latest translation that he has. It means that you're not really thinking about what is going on. You're not really taking care. You're not being careful. Heedless is like the opposite of being careful. So heedlessness, I think, is a good translation for that word. And it says, I think, in the Anguttara Nikaya somewhere, it says that if you don't have heedlessness, if you're not heedful, then that is going to block you entirely from being able to practice the path. This is like one of the foundation stones of the path, to be heedful. It's like Kalyanamitta, having good friends, and having right view, and certain of these things, and heedfulness is one of them. It's a kind of very basic thing. Unless you have that, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not even going to get started on this path. And some of these other ones here are important ones that you see many places in the suttas. Obviously, envy is quite an important one. You see it in many places. Avarice here should really be a stinginess. And stinginess is something which obviously is very important, again, because it is a foundation for generosity in one's life. Generosity is a foundation, again, for practicing the path. It's one of the first factors that you start off on the path with, usually, is generosity. So it's obviously an important one to overcome. And there's all kinds of stinginess mentioned in the suttas. There is, of course, material stinginess. But also stinginess, dhamma stinginess, where you're sort of hoarding your dhamma for yourself and you don't really want to share the dhamma with others. And that's, so there's all kinds of stinginess possible there. Those are some of the defilements. I think it's good to know that they are there. And I think we all have a certain sense of what is a defilement of the mind. I think we basically know that things like conceit and arrogance is defilement. But of course, basically, bring it back to the five hindrances. That is the main thing which we need to come back to. And that is the main thing we need to overcome to be able to move forward on the path. Okay, so these are the imperfections of the mind. Then the Buddha goes on. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Bhikkhu here is, of course, anybody. Knowing that ill will, etc., etc., all the way to heedlessness or negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu or anybody else abandons it. So I should say here, in case somebody, for some people haven't been here before, you find that the suttas are given to the monks, because the Buddha obviously spoke to the monks, to the bhikkhus, more than anybody else. So here he says, quite literally, monks, you should abandon it. But that doesn't mean that the sutta is not just as applicable to anybody else. It is. It's applicable to everybody, nuns, lay people, anybody. This is basically just the path. So here the Buddha is saying that once you know that these are problems, well, then you practice to abandon them. And this is what basically so much of the Buddhist path is all about, abandoning defilements. If you look at the Noble Eightfold Path and you look at it from the beginning all the way up to the jhana states, to Samma Samadhi, it's all just a big path of purification, purifying yourself first through your body and speech, and then the purification of the mind, which happens with right effort and right mindfulness. It's basically a path of purification. And that is one reason why this very famous Theravada Buddhist work is called the Visuddhimagga, which literally means the path of purification. That's where it comes from. So the Eightfold Path is a path of purification. So what this is saying here in brief is how is that you should practice that Eightfold Path to abandon these defilements. What does abandoning mean in this context? Now, the word abandoning in Pali can mean many things, but usually in this kind of context, it means like the temporary abandonment of something, so that you can have like deep states of meditation from it. So pahana is the Pali word. It usually means like the temporary abandonment, like when you abandon the five hindrances before you enter a state of samadhi. The other question here, which I find is interesting, what does it mean knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind? What is the knowing that is spoken of here? And this is one of those cases where I think that you can actually read this in many different ways, on many different levels. This is one of the interesting things about the suttas, is that they are not always, don't always have one particular specific meaning here. Very often they can have many different levels of meaning in them. And you see that when you read suttas like in the Sanghita Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, and you have somebody goes up to the Buddha and they say a verse, and they say, well, this is how I understand this verse. And then somebody else goes up to the Buddha and says, well, this is how I understand it, and it's a different understanding. And then a third person and a fourth person does the same thing. And everybody understands the verse in a different way. And then they ask the Buddha, well, who has spoken rightly? Who is right? And they're sort of, I'm not sure if it's one-upmanship or what it is, but it's they certainly want to find out what is who is whether they have spoken right or not. And the Buddha invariably says, you have all spoken right. It's all correct. And then the Buddha gives his own version, which probably is then the highest or the most kind of applicable version. But the point is that the Dhamma is always multifaceted, and you can read these things in many different ways, and there isn't necessarily any one particular way which is right. And it's important to know that. But at the same time, it's also important to know that there are many ways of reading which is wrong. So just because you can read it in many ways doesn't mean that any way of reading it is right either. So you still have to fall within certain parameters. So these two factors, there can be many ways, but there certainly are many more wrong ways to read it than there are right ways. So what does knowing here mean then? And I think it can mean at least three different things in this particular context. And the first one is simply that you have an understanding, maybe a theoretical understanding, given by reading the discourses of the Buddha, hearing the Dhamma from your teacher, or whatever it is, or just maybe your own intuition, that these are defilements. And from that theoretical understanding, then you start abandoning these things. So that is one way of looking at this. And of course, then, as you practice in that way, you go all the way up till they are completely abandoned and eradicated, so the mind becomes entirely and completely pure. Another way of looking at this is to understand the knowing here is the kind of knowing that you have after you have already abandoned these defilements at least once. In other words, it's the kind of knowledge that you have after you've had an attainment of samadhi or jhana, or something profound. Because it is really only when you have had an attainment, when you have seen something deep, when you have purified the mind once completely, that you can actually know what the defilements are. Because some of these defilements, and I'm sure Ajahn Brahm has spoken about this before as well many times here, this is the sort of things he speaks about in the monastery, some of these defilements are very, very refined, and it's very hard to see them. You may not feel particularly greedy, or you may not have any anger, or you may not even feel particularly restless, you may feel quite clear, but still there may be some very refined defilements lurking in the mind. And you don't even know they're there. And you can't know they're there because you're so used to having them there. There's so much part of your personality and who you are that it's very hard to spot these defilements. And that's why I say that one way of reading this, understanding this, is that that knowledge of what the defilements are only arises after you've had like a deep state of samadhi and jhana or whatever. That's when you have true knowledge. That's when you have seen these defilements fully. And then, of course, once you have that knowledge, then you can start abandoning them. In other words, when those defilements start arising again in the future, you keep on abandoning them again and again and again, going into samadhi again and again and again, and practicing in this way. So that is the second way of understanding the word knowing in this context. Another final way, which I think is possible here, is to understand the knowledge here to mean stream entry. Somebody who's become a sotapanna, who has seen the teachings of the Buddha fully for themselves. Because it's only really when you see the teachings of the Buddha fully that you have, again, a very clear vision of what the defilements are. Even if you have a jhana attainment, you may actually forget maybe or not remember properly what the pure mind exactly is like. But once you become a stream enterer, you have a very clear vision. You know what the defilements are. Because your mind tends not to be obstructed by these things, you have a complete clarity about these particular issues. And because of that, it becomes much easier for you to abandon defilements in the future. When they arise again, because you have very clear knowledge of what they are, it's possible for you to abandon these things with relative ease, because you know what they are at the very least. So these are three ways of understanding that little passage, and I think they may all be right. Then again, there might be another way which is even more right. You never know what is going on, but I think that's pretty close to what is meant here. So the Buddha then goes on. When a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when a bhikkhu has known that ill will, etc., etc., all the way down to heedlessness is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, he acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha thus. And then we have the standard summary of the qualities of the Buddha. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leaders of persons to be tamed, teachers of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. So what we are seeing here is that this, of course, when it says that he acquires perfect confidence, it means that he becomes a stream enterer, because this is what it means to be a stream enterer. Stream enterer has seen the Dhamma. He has understood the Four Noble Truths. And because you know what the Buddha is talking about, you obviously at that point you acquire what he here calls perfect confidence. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's latest translation here is confirmed confidence. It's confirmed because you have seen the teaching for yourself. That's why it's confirmed. It's confirmed by your own insight. So it is interesting here because it is not very clear exactly why the person should have acquired perfect or confirmed confidence at this particular stage. It doesn't say anywhere in the text that he actually becomes a stream mentor, a sort of anaha. So I would say here that what is happening here is that, as is very common in the suttas, a few steps in the practice have been sort of left out, and you have to infer them from the context. So what is happening here is that you abandon all the defilements of the mind. When you abandon all the defilements, that's when you have access to the deep states of samadhi. And of course, when you have access to the deep states of samadhi, then you also have then it's accordance with nature, that you will see things in accordance with a reality, in accordance with how they actually are. This is what happens when you have samadhi. You see things in the right way. And when you keep doing that enough times, you keep abandoning the defilements, you keep accessing samadhi again and again, it is virtually assured that eventually you will become a stream winner, simply because it is in accordance with nature, that if you practice samadhi enough, the jhanas enough, you must see things eventually as they actually are. So as I said, this is what is going on here. We see the defilements of the mind having been abandoned. Because they have been abandoned, the person has access to the jhanas and to samadhi. And if he keeps on doing that again and again and again, eventually he will break through to become a stream winner, a stream enterer. This is just the nature of the path. This is how it works. There's a beautiful sutta in the Anguttara Tens which talks about the nature of the path. And it's very clear that it says that when you practice the path, each step on the path follows on from the next one. And it follows on from the next one in such a way that the subsequent step is a consequence of the step before. It has to happen. So if you have a strong faith, or you have good virtuous conduct, it is in accordance with nature that you will feel a sense of gladness and happiness inside of you. When you have that happiness, you will feel joy, and they will come into the sequence afterwards, actually, all the way up to samadhi. And then when you have samadhi, it is in accordance with nature that you will see things as they actually are. The yata bhuta jnana dasana. It just happens. So somebody who practices samadhi a lot, it is to be expected that they will see things in accordance with reality. So that is how you. This happens essentially. This is just the way things work. So that is how I would read that particular paragraph there. According to the commentary, at this point, the person has already become an anagami, a non-returner. I'm not sure why the commentary says that, because if you take the text at its face value, it's basically saying a stream enterer. Of course, if you are a stream enterer here, it could mean anybody, any Arya Pugala, up to Arahant, but not an Arahant. But there's nothing in the text which says that you have to be an anagami, as far as I can see, at this particular stage. So, because you're a stream enterer, you have this confirmed confidence in the Buddha. And this is the standard phrasing for the qualities of the Buddha. I'm not going to go into this now, because I think we have gone into this here before. But you can see, maybe one little thing that I just should mention very briefly is that the Buddha is called the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. Instead of to be tamed, I prefer tameable there, somebody that can be tamed. Because obviously he's only a leader of those that can be tamed, those that can or are willing to undergo the practice. There are always going to be lots more people who are not willing to do this because they don't understand the Dhamma, because they don't make any sense to them. So he's a leader of those who are tameable, who are willing to undergo the training and are interested in the Buddhist practice. So that is the qualities of the Buddha. Please, if you have any questions at any stage, please raise your hand or whatever, and we'll take it there. Don't feel shy about asking questions. This is one of the great opportunities of coming here. So when you acquire perfect confidence in the Buddha, and of course the reason why you do that is because you have seen the Dhamma. And this is the next one here. So the Buddha says that he acquires perfect confidence in the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So again, you have seen the Dhamma, so you know that the Dhamma works. You know that there is a goal to be achieved in the practice. And of course, he also acquires perfect confidence in the Sangha, or confirmed confidence in the Sangha. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, these are the noble Sangha, the Aryas, those who have seen the Dhamma, that Sangha is practicing the good way, is practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals, this Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So when you have the insight into the Dhamma, you see all of these things come at the same time. Because you have seen the truth that the Buddha spoke, you understand that the Buddha must have been enlightened to be able to see that. And of course, you also understand that those people who practice in accordance with that, they must they are moving towards the goal. And ultimately, the people who practice in accordance with the Dhamma are the Aryas, those who have seen it. The rest of us, we are sort of fumbling around in the dark, trying to move in the right direction. And if we practice well, of course, we're also going the right direction. But we are a little bit in the dark because we're relying on instructions from outside. Once you become an Arya, you become independent, it says in the sutra, independent in the teacher's dispensation, because you have seen the Dhamma for yourself. You know what's going on. And these are, interesting here, these are the ones that are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, because these are the ones that know, these are the ones that have that insight, and they're able to teach directly from the heart. This is what one means by teaching from the heart, because you know what the Dhamma is. You don't no longer need to rely on the suttas, although I must also say that it's good to rely on the suttas, because the Buddha himself said that if you rely on the suttas and if you teach from that, the Dhamma will last long time into the future. Because we all have, in a sense, the same refuge, the same place, the same source that we go to when we teach. If you don't rely on the suttas and you have too many impromptu talks, then after that teacher dies and passes away, nobody really knows what to make of those teachings, because they don't know how it fits together with the suttas, whether it is accurate compared to what the Buddha said, and it becomes forgotten much more easily. So it's good to always relate things back to the suttas again. And that is how I understand what the Buddha himself said, how the Dhamma lasts long into the future if we do that. Okay, so at this point, the person is at least a stream winner, and he has acquired confirmed confidence in the triple gem. And then the Buddha goes on. When he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished these imperfections of the mind in part, in other words, not completely, but in part, this is how we know that he's not an arahant yet, he considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Buddha. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. And in one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated, or the mind gains samadhi, if you like. So what we are seeing here is, again, we are basing ourselves on the stream winner. So again, as often in the suttas, these are very lofty kind of teachings and taught to very lofty individuals. But it, of course, is true on a more mundane level as well. But it certainly is true for the stream winner and above. That when you reflect on the fact that you have this perfect confidence in the Buddha, you're reflecting on the Buddha because you know that the teaching works, because you know who the Buddha is, you know his qualities, because you have direct insight into all of that, It is natural that when you think about that, it will make you feel glad. Here you are, you got the best teacher in the world. You got the teacher who really knows the path. You know the Dhamma of that teacher. You know the Dhamma works, that it will take you to happiness and away from suffering, towards enlightenment. Of course, when you think about it, it's going to make you feel very happy because you've been fumbling around for so many lifetimes, not really knowing what you're doing. And now you find the way out of this problem. So of course, you're going to feel a sense of inspiration inside of you. And that is why these kind of reflections become so powerful once you are a stream winner, because then you have seen and you know the truth of this practice. And that's why this reflection in particular is a reflection for stream winners or stream enterers. But of course, it is also a reflection for the rest of us. If you're able to bring up a sense of inspiration and joy by thinking about the Buddha, thinking about the Dhamma or the Sangha, then of course you can use that, but it's not as automatic and as easy for a Putujana, a non-Aryan, as it is for the Aryans. For the Aryans, it's quite automatic, this process. So you can see what's happening here. When he thinks about the Buddha, then he gains inspiration in the meaning. The word meaning here is atta. It also means like the goal of the practice. You get inspiration in the goal. Because you know, again, that this is about overcoming suffering and moving towards happiness, if you like, and ultimately overcoming suffering completely. You get inspiration in that you have found this beautiful path going in the right direction. You get inspiration in the Dhamma. The Dhamma are the teachings that lead towards that goal. The fact that you have these teachings available to you, not only do you have them in your heart as well when you are a stream enterer. So you have these teachings and you gain a sense of inspiration inside of you. This word Veda, Dhamma Veda, Atta Veda, which means like a mixture of knowledge and positive feeling. Because of that inspiration, you get a sense of gladness inside of you. This is a kind of very positive feeling inside of you, which is connected. You get this sense of gladness. And when you have the sense of gladness, you get rapture. And this rapture is the piti. This is one of the factors that we find also in the jhanas. It's present in all states of samadhi. It's this sense of rapture or sense of joy inside of you. You can actually feel it in the body when you go into states of samadhi and meditation. Because you have rapture, you practice that rapture for a while, the body starts to become tranquil. And when the body, if you go beyond that tranquility, deep into that tranquility, you get a state of what is called sukha, happiness. And this sequence you have here, and then of course from the happiness, the mind goes into samadhi. This sequence that you have here is basically a sequence which explains to you in direct experience what happens in meditation practice. So this is what is supposed to happen when you meditate, if you go deep in the meditation. You start off with feeling gladness, a sense of joy because you are doing some sort of practice, reflecting on the Buddha, or maybe doing metta practice, or whatever it is that you're doing. You start to feel a sense of gladness inside of you, that there's something going on here, something powerful going on. And then as you keep focusing on that object, whether it is the recollection of the Buddha, or it is anapanasati, or metta, what it is, as you keep focusing, you go through these stages. These are like stages of the mind that you go through as you practice. So gladness, then comes the rapture, when the whole body feels like a sense of joy almost. And then as you progress even further, that rapture starts to calm down, and you come to the tranquility. And as you go beyond that, the sense of happiness arises, the happiness that comes from a tranquil body and a tranquil mind. And then comes the samadhi here. So this is like a standard sutta explanation for the process of meditation from the experiential point of view. This is how meditation process should be experienced when it actually works. So this is how the sutta has explained to you the process of meditation basically here. This is the experiential one. This is not the kind of the technical one when you talk about, you know, looking at the breath in such and such a way, etc., which is more like the technical side. This is the experiential side. So this is what you do when you reflect on the Buddha and you are a stream winner, stream enter in particular. Then there are two alternative ways of reflecting for the Arya. And this, the first one then is, he considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Dhamma. And he gains inspiration in the meaning or the goal. He gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. And then when he's glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Sangha. And he gains inspiration in the goal, inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he's glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. And then there is a fourth way that the Aryan can think, and this again is another very well-known meditation method that is taught in the suttas, and this is called the Sila Nupassana, the reflection on your virtues. The first three ones we've looked at now is, of course, the Buddha Nupassana, the Buddha Nusati, I should say, the recollection of the Buddha. Then you have the Dhamma Nusati and the Sangha Nusati. These are things you see again and again in the suttas, the recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha. But then you have the Sila Nusati, the recollection of virtue. And again, this is something which is more powerful for an Arya than for anybody else. But of course, again, it works for everybody to some extent, because the Arya has given up certain defilements completely. And it will tend to be a very pure person in their conduct, this Arya. But it's something that can be used for everybody. And I think it's something we all should do sometimes, to remind ourselves that we are keeping the five precepts, that we're doing something good in the world, that we are actually helping out, and that there are lots of beings out there. There are animals and humans, whatever, that benefit from the fact that we are good. If we hadn't been good, they would have been suffering much, much more. At least we are sparing them the suffering. Perhaps we are even creating some happiness for them by our good actions. And remember that, because this is like a good kind of happiness that we should all dwell on as Buddhists. And it's something maybe which we tend to forget, and something which can be difficult for us. But try to bring that up, because it is a wholesome thing. It's a positive thing. Don't make something, make an ego out of it, but make it into some just a good feeling inside of you. And this is the way that you're supposed to think about this, according to this sutta. He considers thus, the imperfections of the mind have been given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished by me. And by thinking like that, he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he's glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. So that is the Sila Nusati. And then we come to the next stage here. The Buddha continues, Bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such a state of samadhi, and such wisdom, eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice, along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. Just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too, if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such concentration, such wisdom, eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice, etc., even that will be no obstacle for him. And the point here is interesting. One might wonder, well, why suddenly this paragraph in here? It doesn't seem to fit very well into the kind of the the sequence here. Why suddenly talk about alms food? It doesn't seem to make much sense. And it's interesting here that in the one of the Chinese versions of this particular suttas, there are three Chinese versions of this sutta, and in one of the Chinese versions, there is a Brahmin who appears at the very beginning of the sutta. And this Brahmin is sort of critical of the Buddha for eating too much good food. And this then here is like the Buddha's response to that Brahmin. He's saying, well, actually, if you are wise enough, if your meditation is deep enough, it is not a problem to eat food that is, even the best of food is no problem for you. So it makes very good sense in that Chinese version of that particular sutta. It's a bit unclear why it suddenly appears here in the Pali. So what does it mean? What's actually going on here? First of all, when we look at this, it says such virtue, such concentration, such wisdom. It seems to refer back to the stream enter, because we've just been talking about the stream enter before. Although the commentary says that it refers to the non-returner, the anagami. And I don't know, I think either one is probably a possible interpretation here. Of course, if you are an anagami, you have given up all sensual desire, all ill will. Of course, any kind of food is never, ever going to be a problem for you because all those things have been left behind. But I think that even as a stream enter, because you know the Dhamma, you know the path, you know the problems, the defilements and all these things, even for the stream enter, it's not such a big problem if you have good food. Because it's, at the very most, it's a very kind of temporary problem for you. And in fact, if you look at the simile here, I think the simile here points us towards the stream enter rather than the anagami. Because the simile says, just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water. So, in other words, a cloth that is an anagami is incapable of having a defiled mind. It cannot happen for somebody who is a non-returner because they have abandoned all the sensual desire. But a stream enter is possible for them to have desire and craving arise, at least temporarily, but because of the purity of their mind, because the purity of the insight, they can very quickly clear that mind up again and remove those stains, just like clear water removes the stains and the cloth becomes pure and bright again. And this is one of the qualities that you find in the sutta. The sutta talks about the stream entry, and one of the ways that the suttas talk about stream entry is in terms of a cloth that takes dye in a very even and beautiful way. When you become a stream enter, that is the simile there is that the cloth which is clean takes the color that it is dyed with evenly and beautifully. That is what it said about the stream enter. And you can imagine what is going on there. What is happening there, I think, is that the mind which is defiled is not able to see things according to reality. In other words, there's like a dirt in the mind which makes it impossible for you to see things as they actually are. But when the mind, the dirt of the mind is removed, you can see things exactly as they are, then the mind is able to do that. In exactly the same way with a cloth that is dirty, you put it in nice, beautiful colors, you try to dye it in a beautiful way, but because of the stains in the cloth, the color doesn't come out properly on that cloth. However, if the cloth is clean, the colors come out exactly as they are supposed to be, in exactly the right way, in exactly the same way as a stream enter sees things in the way they actually are. That, I think, may be what is meant by that particular simile. It's found in many places in the suttas. So because of that, the stream enter is somebody whose mind already has been dyed, so to speak, with those pure bright colors, and it's already cloth which is beautiful, which might get stained a little bit, but then you just use a little bit of clear water, as it says here, to remove those stains, and then the mind is beautiful again. So for that reason, I think that what is being talked about here is actually the mind of a stream enter. That would be my guess. Although the commentary, of course, says the non-returner, and that, of course, is obviously important to take note of. Then we come to the deep meditation states. The Brahma Viharas are the next thing here. And it is quite common in the suttas for the Brahma Viharas to be like a vehicle, the practice you do to bring you either to non-returner or to full enlightenment, to anagami or arahatship. So this is another reason why I think up till now we have seen the stream enter, and now we are seeing the practice that leads either to full enlightenment or to someone becoming a non-returner. And these Brahma Viharas, these divine abidings, they read as follows. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So this is the standard explanation in the suttas for loving kindness practice. And we can see here that this is a very high state of loving kindness. You are spreading this loving kindness to the whole world. And we can see there's nothing which is left out of your field of perception. Everything, everybody, all beings are included in that loving kindness practice. So this is a very powerful thing, obviously. And just briefly again, loving kindness is the well-wishing to other beings, wishing them well, wishing them happiness, having this beautiful intention of other beings being happy out there. And again, it's important to remember that for loving kindness to be possible, for you to be able to have, to wish somebody well, you have to see in them something good, something positive. If you are angry with somebody, it's very hard to have loving kindness. In fact, it's impossible. These are exact opposite states of mind. So very often we have to sort of start off with building up loving kindness by seeing the good in somebody. So they must be worthy of our intention of happiness, of them being, may you be happy, may you be well. You must feel that the person is worthy of that. If the person isn't worthy of that, you cannot have that intention. So you have to build up that sense of worthiness of the other person, first of all. And then you can have slowly build up the loving kindness. And you will see here, quite interesting, is that in the suttas, the way that loving kindness is described, it's not described as radiating to particular people or even any other beings. It's always radiated to the directions, everywhere, out there, into the world. I find that quite fascinating. And this is something sometimes might have an advantage in that you are just radiating to faceless beings, which don't have a particular name, they're not anybody particular, they're just beings out there. Because then you can have a general idea of what a being is like in your mind, and you can have a sense of loving kindness towards those beings. So that is the loving kindness meditation. It's the well-wishing towards others. And then we have the other three divine abidings. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So we have the compassion here, first of all. Compassion is seeing the suffering in other beings and the wish to alleviate that suffering, the sense of pain that we also feel when you see the pain in others. Altruistic joy is seeing the success in other beings, seeing that they are succeeding, seeing their good qualities, etc. And feeling a sense of joy along with them when you see those good qualities in other people. And equanimity is just a very even state of mind. And this is the highest here, which is interesting. Equanimity is actually above all the other ones. Because the mind then is very, very even and very much and very sharp because of that evenness. It has the ability to penetrate much deeper, because ultimately this is going to be about insight and about understanding the world as it actually is. In all of these cases, one of the things about interesting in the suttas is that these divine abidings, they tend to go together with the four jhanas. So you have the four jhanas, you have the four Brahma viharas, the divine abidings, and you also have the three lower immaterial attainments. And they are like the things which are standard equipment that you use to have insight into the truth, to gain enlightenment, in other words. And one thing which I find is fascinating is that these divine abidings are usually placed slightly higher than the jhana practices. And it's interesting why that is. Why is it that the divine abidings are higher than the jhanas? And I must admit, I'm not entirely sure, because they tend to lead to the jhanas in themselves. But presumably it is because there is something additional. If you just watch the breath, it's a very kind of... you're watching the breath, it is still a very exalted state, of course, but there's something more powerful emotion that comes out of this practice when you practice the divine abidings than if you just watch the breath. And it is that extra emotion that I think you probably can gain, particularly afterwards, after you come out of the jhana state. There's a residue, a powerful emotion there of compassion and loving kindness that comes with it, because you have been practicing these things to enter the jhana in the first place. And that is why I think they are considered slightly higher. And it is said in the sutta that if you do practice things like metta consistently, again and again and again, day in, day out, then it is impossible for you to become angry. So it's almost like having abandoned the defilement of anger entirely. An alternative way of doing that is practicing metta all the time. And you should never become angry. You can know with certainty that you still haven't practiced metta to its limit if you ever get any kind of anger or irritation arising in your life. That is how high this can go, how far it can go. So it's very, very lofty states we're talking about here. And that is why I think that they are slightly higher than the ordinary jhanas, although they are basically on the same level. And this is the kind of practice that the Brahmins ideally would have practiced at the time of the Buddha. They would have practiced these Brahma Viharas, and they would call this unity or unification with Brahma. So, that's the four Brahma Viharas. And so now the person has practiced, he is already a stream enterer, he has also now practiced the Samadhi to a very, very high level. Presumably all the four jhanas are included in this, because we're talking about equanimity here, and equanimity is like the hallmark of the fourth jhana. Once you have come to that point, then you are ready for insight. And this is what this next passage is all about, is about insight. He understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from this whole field of perception. So this is an insight practice. He understands these things. And again, he understands it quite naturally because he is an Arya. What does this mean? And I think there may be many explanations possible. I will give you an explanation which I like, and I will tell you the commentarial explanation afterwards. But the way I like to see this is that there is this would seem to refer to the things that we've just been talking about, the Brahma Viharas. There is this. There are these Brahma Viharas. So that's the starting point. Then it says there is the inferior, hina in Pali, which literally means like low. Now I would understand that to mean, well, the Brahma Viharas, they are essentially equivalent to what we know as the Rupa Loka or the Rupa Bhava in the Pali language. This is the existence, fine material existence, that you can get reborn in if you practice these jhanas or Brahma Viharas. So this is like one of the three worlds. We're talking about the three worlds in Buddhism. And this is like the intermediate world, is the rebirth into a jhana realm. So that's what that is. There is the inferior. Well, I take that to be the worlds which are below that, the Kama Loka. The Kama Loka is the world of sense objects, the world of sensual pleasures and sensual displeasures. That is what is inferior here. It's lower, and it's quite commonly called that the sort of indulgence in karma, in sensual pleasures, is actually often called inferior or low in the suttas. And then it says there is the superior. And this word in Pali is panita. Panita means like something which is like sublime or delightful. And this word is used in two different ways. It is used either for nibbana, or it can also be used for the immaterial attainments. And I think here it might well mean the immaterial attainments, which is the last of the three worlds. So what you have here is you have the three worlds which comprise everything in samsara. So you have, this is the whole samsara basically we're talking about here. The kamaloka, which is the inferior, the rupaloka, which are the four Brahma Viharas or the four jhanas, and then the superior, which are the immaterial attainments. So the whole of samsara is here included in these three things. And then, because he is a stream enterer, he knows that beyond these things, there is an escape from this whole field of perception. In other words, as long as you're part of samsara, you're going to have perception. And samsara can be considered like a whole field of perception. Everything from the lowest realm to the highest realm are just different perceptions that you have, different ways of looking. And beyond all these perceptions that constitute samsara, you have this escape, which is nibbana. You completely go out of the whole thing. And that is the ending of the fields of perception. So that is one way of understanding it. And this is how the stream enterer would look upon these things. Another way of understanding this, and this is the commentarial understanding, is there is this, refers to the Brahma Viharas that we have just seen again. But in this case, he understands this Brahma Viharas as consisting of the five khandas. The five khandas are involved here. And of course, the five khandas are suffering. So in this case, he's actually, according to the commentary, focusing on the first noble truth, because he understands that even these lofty states called the Brahma Viharas are part of the first noble truth. They are suffering. There is the inferior. And here the commentary says, well, this refers to the second noble truth, the craving. Craving is inferior, and it is something, it's a low kind of quality, hina. And then there is the superior. This, the commentary takes to be the Noble Eightfold Path. And then the last one, beyond there is an escape, the commentary says is Nibbana. It might be possible to reverse the last two ones and say that the superior actually is Nibbana, because then you have the Four Noble Truths in sequence. The superior is Nibbana, and the escape from this whole thing is the Noble Eightfold Path. That's what you practice to go beyond these things. So that is how the commentary sees that. And again, I think it's quite possible that both of those ways of looking at it might be possible in this particular case. At that point, when you understand that, when you see this whole samsara as suffering, as a problem, and you want to get out of the whole thing, then you're seeing the three characteristics in everything, then you can make the breakthrough. And you can become fully enlightened. And that is what is happening at the next stage here. You become fully enlightened. And that's why it starts off in this way. When he knows and sees thus, in other words, he sees everything as tainted by the three characteristics, impermanent, suffering, and non-self. When he knows and sees this, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, in other words, the taint of existence, basically, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed, or birth is ended. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of existence. Because this bhikkhu is called bathed with the inner bathing here. So, this is what happens when you become fully enlightened. And you see here, you become liberated from the taint of sensual desire. Taint, the Pali word is asava, taint. And asava is sometimes translated as inflowing, something which flows into you. But the meaning in the sutta, as far as I can make out, seems to be outflowing. mind always goes out into the world, out into enjoyment, out into trying to exist in one way or another, into being somebody. There is a sutta which talks about a sore. If you have a sore on the body, and that sore gives off like matter, pus or whatever, that is called an asava. But of course, a sore, a pus coming out of a sore comes out. It's an outflowing. It's not an inflowing. And that's why I think that it actually means outflowing. Although many scholars would disagree with me, and they would say it actually means influx or inflowing instead. But in any case, it has a kind of general meaning as a taint. In other words, as something which is like a spot, something which is bad, something which has a bad connotation to it. Taint of sensual desire is destroyed, is liberated from that. The taint of being, this means that you don't really have any desire anymore to exist. You have destroyed the desire for existence because you realize that existence is just suffering. Existence is another term for suffering. There is no distinction between the two. And also the taint of ignorance. You have destroyed the misunderstanding of what the world actually is like. You now see it perfectly in accordance with what it actually is. And that is destruction of the taint of ignorance. When the mind is liberated, this is important, the knowledge comes, it is liberated. You know when you're an arahant, you know when you're enlightened. It's not something which you think, maybe I am, maybe not. If you have any doubts whatsoever, you can be absolutely sure that you're not enlightened. You know that. Not only do you know that, but you also know that birth has been ended. You know that there will be no more life in the future. You can actually see directly with your wisdom that you have destroyed anything that can give rise to future birth. This is one of the knowledges of the arahant. And this is one of the few ways in which it can be said that you can see into the future. You can actually see what's going to happen in the future. There's very little predictions in the suttas. The Buddha didn't really say much about the future. This is one of the few predictions that you can have. When you are fully enlightened, you know that there will be no more birth in the future. The holy life has been lived. You have done your job. You set out to make an end of suffering. You have made an end of suffering, so you have finished the holy life. It says in the suttas that when you become an arahant, your desire, your craving to live the holy life abates. It subsides because obviously there's no point in living this life anymore because you have done your job. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. In other words, there is no more rebirth in the future, no more existence in the future after this. And it's fascinating here. If you look at what this sequence of understandings that the arahant, the enlightened one has, you will see the focus is very much on no more existence in future lives. There are no more future lives. Birth has ended, and there's no more coming to any state of existence. Both of those are focused on that. And the other ones are just saying that the job has been done. They're not really saying anything more. So this is the focus. This is the main aspect of the knowledge of the arahant. He knows that there's no more future birth. This is the purpose of the Buddhist life lived fully, to end rebirth. This is what it's all about. And this is precisely why this is the knowledge that the arahant has, because this is what he has been striving for. And now he has reached that goal of making an end of rebirth. It's important to know that, because there's still, even today, a lot of people saying, I'm a Buddhist, but I don't really believe in rebirth. Well, if you really reject rebirth, in my opinion, if you reject it out of hand, you cannot really be a Buddhist, because it is absolutely central to the Buddha's teachings. At the very least, one should have an open mind to these things. You do not have to have kind of absolute 100% faith. In fact, you probably shouldn't have that either, because you can't really know. But you certainly shouldn't reject it out of hand as absolutely impossible, because then you are rejecting basically what the whole Buddhist teachings is about. So then the Buddha says, then at that point, because this bhikkhu is called one bathed with the inner bathing. And the reason that the Buddha says that at this point is not obvious is because there is a Brahmin present listening to the Buddha who is used to bathing in rivers, like an ablution to wash away his sins of the past, wash away his evil karma of the past, by bathing in holy rivers. This is what they did in India 2,500 years ago. And if you go to India today, lo and behold, they still do the same thing 2,500 years later. This is what is amazing about India. It seems like this one thing which is permanent in samsara, this Indian thing here. India is a very kind of stable society there, it seems. And you can recognize so many things in the suttas. You can recognize that in India today if you ever go there, which is quite, which is nice in a way, because it just confirms the historicity and the validity of the suttas, because you know, you can see that things are still there in the same way. So anyway, so this is why the Buddha said this, that this is what is really called bathing in Buddhism. This is how you get rid of defilements. This is how you get rid of stains, by bathing the mind and destroying those defilements of the mind through this practice of the Dhamma. So then comes the conclusion of the story here. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja was sitting not far from the Blessed One. Then he said to the Blessed One, "But does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River and bathe? Why, Brahmin, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River." So there you go. That was the way things were looked at the time of the Buddha, and it is still the same in the present day. Then the Blessed One addressed the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja in stanzas, in verse. Bahuka en adikaka gaya sundarika tu, payaga en sarasati, and the stream bahumati. A fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify dark deeds. What can the Sundarika bring to pass? What the Payaga? What the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, a man who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. This is the Uposatha. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahmin, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to Gaya? For any well will be your Gaya. So these are the Buddha replying in verse to the Brahmin. And the Brahmin is obviously very impressed with this, these verses, basically saying that you can never wash anything away by just washing in water. You have to actually practice the spiritual life to get rid of these stains. And then he's very impressed, and the Brahmin says, and then he goes on rather, "When this was said, the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja said, 'Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full ordination or admission.' And the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Bharadvaja, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is ended, the holy life has been lived, What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Bharadvaja became one of the Arahants. So that is the beautiful ending of that sutta, another Arahant in the world. And just very briefly there, a couple of minor points. Full admission is the Upasampada, is when you become a bhikkhu, of course. And it says here, not long after full admission. Well, this not long often means, I think the commentary says somewhere else that not long means 12 years or something like that. So it obviously still is a fair amount of time. But in kind of in a samsaric perspective, it is a very short period of time. He dwells diligent and resolute and realizes for himself. This, of course, means he becomes an arahat. And he's called a clansman here. Well, a clansman is just like a name of somebody who comes from a proper family at the time of the Buddha. It's not some kind of a beggar or some kind of a person who, you know, doesn't come from a proper family, whatever that means. But somebody who had a kind of a good life beforehand, and they still chose to ordain and become a monk. That is the main point here. That's what one of the things which the Buddha says is remarkable at the Dhamma, that even people from good families go forth. In other words, you don't just go forth so that you can get a meal the next day or get clothed. You go forth because there actually is something to be realized. And then you see again at the very end there, you see again the Arahant knows birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Again, that's the standard description of becoming arahant. So that is the Vat Upama Sutta. Are there any more questions before we stop off? John Treasure? Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, negligence is just like you. Sometimes you just forget, you know. You forget what you're doing. You forget what you are supposed to be doing. I like the translation heedlessness. You're not heedful. You're not actually reflecting on the teachings. You're not bringing them to mind. You're not. So you end up doing things which you know inside of you shouldn't be doing. You are heedless. You're not actually taking things to heart properly. I think it's really as simple as that. It's also connected with the word just previous to that, which is translated here as vanity. Well, this actually is mada in the Pali language, and it often means like being intoxicated. You have the fifth precept is suramera madja pamadatana. That also has mada in it. Actually, that's a good one because that tells you what negligence means, because you have pamada in there. It's a thing which happens when you get drunk. You get negligent. You don't know right from wrong anymore. You're completely confused. You're just messing around. But mada is intoxication. And this is the kind of thing that you find the Buddha talks about in the suttas. He says, when you are young, you're intoxicated with youth. It's like, yeah, I'm the master of the universe. I can do whatever I like. And you forget that youth doesn't last all that long. Before you know it, you start getting old. And before you know it, you actually are old. And then next thing, you are dead. Or you are healthy, and you think that health is going to last forever. It's like one of these delusions that we're under. We're intoxicated. Yeah, I feel strong, I feel healthy, I can go out and do all kinds of things. And you forget that actually it's the nature of the body to be unhealthy as well. Health and unhealth, disease and ease go together. So this is also part of negligence, I think, is this kind of we forget the reality of the world around us. We get intoxicated by the sense of, you know, being healthy, being alive, being young, or whatever else it is. And of course, part of that intoxication is because we don't see things properly. We don't see impermanence. We don't see the characteristics of the world. You happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, but that's what it is basically. It's like north, east, west, and south, the four quarters. That's all it means. It means like the four directions. That's what it means. That's why you have up and down as well, because You know, this is how you take everything into account by the four quarters and up and down, then you have everything basically here. That's how it. Yeah. Well, the point with this is that you are supposed to have metta to all, to everybody, no barriers, right? And this is one of the things which I didn't mention, but which is part of this formula. It's immeasurable, exalted, right? Abundant. It's, in other words, there is no limit to your loving kindness. There is no kind of group or person or being which is outside of that radiation. So the point here is just to say that it goes everywhere. But sometimes it's difficult to start off like that. Sometimes you have to start off in a way which works for you with a particular person or a particular method that you have, you know, worked up that works for you to bring up the feeling. And then you can start radiating to the directions. This is already a very high level of metta, which is described here. You can conceivably, I think, start in this way. But many people will start off with doing it to individuals instead. But often you have to experiment a little bit and see what works. People are different. People are, you know, have different capacities. I think I don't really. I mean, there is. You know, if you talk about outside of Buddhism, the feeling I get is that there wasn't that much meditation going on in India in those days. I mean, there were certain teachers that obviously were very special. The Buddha had his own teachers. But I don't think that there is any clear description in any other, scriptures. Like, for example, you have the Vedas, the scriptures of the Hindu scriptures of the time. As far as I know, there aren't any clear descriptions in the Vedas about this sort of meditation. I think this is basically like the invention of the Buddha. This is what he set up, this particular thing here. Yeah? As far as I know. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? Yes, sir. Yeah. Indeed. No, you're very right. You're saying that it's difficult to see the good in somebody if they're hostile to you or there is a sense of hostility between you. It is very true. And one of the important things to do with people always is to see people in a different way and try to understand them. Why are they hostile? What's going on here? Try to get some understanding which removes some of that anger before you practice loving kindness. How can you have loving kindness towards somebody who you are angry with? You can't. These are diametrically opposite things, you know? So yes, you have to be wise and you have to think about people and realize that, you know, there is no self there. The reason why they are hostile to you is because of causes and conditions in the past. They are as much a victim of those causes and conditions as you are. Most people don't want to be angry. Most people don't want to go out and, you know, do bad things to other people. But sometimes they just can't help themselves because of causes and conditions from the past. And this is the kind of way you have to start thinking here. You have to think that they are owners of the karma. You know, they will suffer much more from their bad acts than you will ever do, because karma is always multiplied many, many fold. From, you know, your acts are, you know, you get it in return 100-fold or 1,000-fold in the future. So yes, no, I agree. Indeed, it's very important to do that. And the more you can actually neutralize any anger or irritation or whatever you have before you do that meditation, the more powerful that meditation is going to be for you. And another way, of course, of doing it is that when you do metta, the reason why you never start off with a hostile person in the beginning is because you want to build up some of that metta, first of all. And once it builds up, and once you have a sense of that metta in there, then you move it on to the hostile person. Because once you have overcome your anger or whatever, then you are able to bring that person into that field of loving kindness you have. So either way, but they always go together, and it's always good to try to forgive people who we feel are difficult, you know? I mean, this is a very big part of the practice. So by all, you know, certainly that's very, very important. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Is that, are you happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Anybody else? Any more? Any final things? Cheng here. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's also important to remember that gladness here. It's quite a deep and powerful feeling inside of you. It's a kind of. It's not just a I'm glad to see you kind of thing. You know. It's a kind of quite strong feeling of gladness of joy or whatever you want to call it inside of you. Huh? So it's not just a kind of mundane form of gladness. It's a very kind of strong, when you feel that you have done the right thing, you've been a good person, and whatever. And you have this natural joy inside of you because of that. That's what it's all about. Yeah. Mudita, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I indeed. So people are on all different stages on the path, so you have to make sure you practice all the stages, and then you will get there. Okay, so let's pay respect to Triple Gem.